Hello, welcome. You're listening to Weejay Meccano on Hollow Earth Radio. It's Sunday night, and we got a very special show in store for you. We got Steve Sewell here to talk about his new show that's open at the Four Culture Gallery. When's that playthrough?
February 1st.
It's called Behind the Curve, and we got Liz Patterson here, art historian, curator, to kind of help facilitate the conversation we're going to have with Steve about his show. He's also going to do some live performance behind the accordion. So they're right here right now. I'm going to turn their mics on. You guys want to do a quick check? You should just like one. Like, yeah, you can use that mic, Liz.
Can you hear me?
Try again.
Can you hear me?
One more time.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Try that mic.
Is this better?
Yeah. Yeah, that's louder.
Okay.
But,
scoot over.
Okay, so I don't know. You want to kick us off, Liz, with some questions?
Yeah, sure. So, first question is, you know, Steve, can you talk a little bit about the title of your show and maybe just describe, you know, for listeners what it's like to walk through the gallery?
Sure. Yeah, so the title of the exhibit is Behind the Curve, and the exhibit itself is composed of a couple of video works and then also a kind of collection of memorabilia of mine that is very much involved with the band The Replacements, who, of course, were playing prior to us coming on. But the title Behind the Curve, for me, kind of simultaneously describes The Replacements and also my kind of relationship to them, with them being a band that never quite had any kind of commercial success and fame, that they came very close. And then, of course, me finding out about them kind of at a later date. So that's essentially, you know, what you see in the gallery. There, the two video works, one is a longer work of about 25 minutes that kind of weaves a couple of different things together, one being a kind of drier history of The Replacements, and then it's mixed in with kind of these documentary shots of me talking about my relationship with them. And then the shorter one being, you know, a little more of a outlier where it looks more at kind of a relationship to an object that I encounter in kind of my everyday life.
Okay, and so I know in that first video that you mentioned, you're talking about your experience with The Replacements and sort of your history with them. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that, because it's, you know, for someone just coming into the gallery, you might not realize this, but you're totally lying throughout your talk. And so maybe you can elaborate a little bit about that and also how that puts you behind the curve.
Right, right. So by the time I actually heard about The Replacements, they had no longer been a band for probably over 10 years at that point. And yet at the time that I heard about them, I thought they were just like the best fucking band I'd ever heard. So they became this like big influence on me at a younger age, and then have kind of sustained my interest going on to that. But the kind of documentary or maybe mockumentary interview footage of me are kind of these half-truths that are based off of somewhat how I first encountered them, stories that, excuse me, I know as a result of friends that actually did encounter them, and then also just kind of fabrications that I've devised based on just kind of my own experiences going to shows and playing music in the past as well.
Cool. And so about that same video, you talk about when you first heard the song Fuck School, which I think was the first song that we heard tonight, and how you immediately became a fan after hearing it. And I'm just curious, you know, is that actually true? And, you know, about that, revolving around that story, can you explain?
Yeah, that is a true story. I was probably 14 years old, and a teacher from high school introduced me to The Replacements. Some of the details have been adjusted a little bit in the video work, but it pretty much is almost all true. I did kind of get this cassette from him, and he had mentioned, he was like, you know, I think this is the one that has Fuck School on it. And I remember playing it, and his son, for some strange reason, was with him, and it started to play, and it definitely was fuck school, and he was like, yeah, maybe you should turn that down a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. And that was your teacher, right, who gave that to you?
Yeah, he was my high school biology teacher.
Sounds like a good mentor.
Yeah, that's a cool teacher. Which brings me to my question, kind of, right? The other night we were talking about how you played in a lot of bands in high school, which you didn't go into how many, actually. I'm kind of curious. But more to that point, you said that you did that kind of as an escape from school. So I was wondering how that relates to this, or if it does at all. Or
sure. Yeah, I did. I really only played in, like, one real band in high school, which was called The Blaggards. But
What defines a real band?
Well, that was the only one that was. We actually started writing our own songs. Okay. Everything else was just playing covers and fooling around.
Gotcha.
Which is
okay.
Fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was like the one band that I was in that actually made legitimate attempts to write and record our own music. But I don't know that I so much played in it to avoid school. I at one point was kind of uncertain as to whether or not I was going to go to undergrad, because I was in this band and thought that, like, maybe we could go tour and get a record deal or something to become famous. And then instead decided to go to college and major in art.
All right, yeah.
And that actually leads to one of my questions, which is, so last November, a year ago, you gave an artist talk about your work at UW. You were just in your second year of your MFA at UW, in case you guys don't know that. And so I was just wondering if, you know, what did you discuss in that artist talk, and why did you approach it in that way?
Right, yeah. So the talk was actually entirely about The Replacements. The kind of venue for it was, it was supposed to be a talk about my work, and I had decided that it would be interesting to attempt to discuss my interest in my work by kind of using The Replacements as a model for doing so. And that's really why I've been so interested in them, beyond being 14 and thinking that the song Fuck School was really great, is there are just a lot of things that they did and decisions that they made in regard to how they approached writing music and how they approached kind of distributing it that I felt were very poignant and kind of relevant to my own interests in art as well. So the talk was a talk exclusively about The Replacements that also kind of, if you were familiar with some of my previous works and interests, kind of became a performance of sorts, where it became on some level just a refusal to talk about my own work, but rather to kind of appropriate a model that someone else had used to maybe kind of explore those ideas. Yeah. And that segued kind of also into the development of this exhibit.
Yeah, sorry, but that was one of the things I thought was really cool about your exhibit, was to show kind of, and we just showed some of it here, but how blatantly they just rip off other art or artists. And like, you had a juxtaposition of different album covers.
Mm-hmm.
I think did you have the Let It Be one there, or?
Yeah, Let It Be is there. The one that's like really blatant is the cover of,
yeah, what was that
Please
called?
To Meet Me, is just like a really great reproduction of an Elvis record called G.I. Blues. That was actually the soundtrack to a movie that came out in like 1963 or something. but with some obscure reference that they decided to just copy and put right,
saw it somewhere
right,
like
there.
Probably similar to the way they chose to do the Beatles album. You want to talk about that real fast? That was really, really interesting. If you didn't catch that, we just played Mr. Worley by The Replacements and also Oh Darling by The Beatles, and just a complete total rip off of The Beatles, which is awesome. And I like that they bookend it in a totally different way, but
yeah.
But that middle section is clearly Oh Darling, sorry.
Yeah, so the last album The Replacements did with Twin Tone Records was titled Let It Be, which when they told the label they were going to do that, they were, of course, just like, no, you can't possibly title your album Let It Be. And actually, in the longer video in the exhibit, this actually does get mentioned in kind of the longer narrative about the replacements, but there's a couple different rumors about why they decided to name that album Let It Be. One was that they fully intended to break up after the record's release, just like the Beatles did after Let It Be came out. And
the rumor
was that they were just going to break up after that album, so that's why they decided to call it that. The other rumor was that they were on tour and driving down the road and decided that whatever the next song to come on the radio was going to be the title of their next album, and it was Let It Be.
Seems like you're opening yourself up for a major disaster there, too, like, depending on what comes on the radio.
So I remember in that talk that you gave over a year ago, you I think you described when they destroyed their own, was it their own records or something?
Yeah.
It just kind of reminds me a little bit of that piece of the Henry Art Gallery, so I don't know if maybe you could talk about that and how you're, you know, painting yourself out of the picture and sort of, like, destroying and creating at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Replacements anecdote is they had signed with Sire Records, which is a subsidiary of Warner Brothers, and were kind of in a bad relationship with their former label, Twin Tone, and I don't really know the entire details, if it was, you know, something about money or they just felt like pulling a prank, but on one particular day, the Replacements decided to go over to Twin Tone Records, walk into the studio, go into the recording rooms, and grab some master tapes of their recordings and steal them, take them out of the building, and then dump them in the Mississippi River.
So did they own the rights to the master tapes?
I don't know.
Was that owned by Twin Tone?
I assume it was owned by Twin Tone. Mm-hmm. And this is also kind of one of the things that I flesh out a little bit more in the longer video, because it's something that I think is really interesting, not only in relation to just kind of some of the stuff that they did, but also in thinking about kind of power struggles and establishing control and ownership over a product, and where that kind of, you kind of define those lines in terms of creativity and ownership. So whether or not they were concerned that, you know, Twin Tone owed them money, so they just decided, well, fuck you, we're going to just totally get rid of our music rather than let that happen, or if they just were scared that Twin Tone was going to start, you know, using it for purposes that they didn't want, I'm not sure. But essentially decided that it might be better for it just to never exist than to risk having anything else done to it.
So does that mean that they can never release a remastered version? Or?
Well, the real kind of joke was apparently they didn't get the master tape. Oh.
Whoops.
They got earlier recordings of some, like, B-sides or something. So they're still all out, which, like, so now you can buy them all on, like, CD or download them from iTunes or whatever. But the piece in the Henry that I did, as you mentioned, it was titled Taking Myself Out of the Picture, and was a video that was projected in a gallery and depicted myself painting a white wall black. And it was set up so that with the light levels in the room, as I started painting the wall black, it just kind of started to disappear against the wall. And then once that gets done, it goes a step further and I start painting myself until eventually I've removed myself entirely from the image and more or less left standing in a dark room. And then from that point, the piece kind of loops and starts over.
Going back to the video that you did that's up at 4Culture right now, I was just curious about how you, can you explain the aspects of the video when you're filming yourself walking through the gallery, and also the film stills of the bookshelves with small objects on them. Mm-hmm. And I know it's something we've talked about before with your work too, but I'm curious, you know, is this your way of pointing out how we attach ourselves to art objects kind of as fans? And is that also why your work is sort of not for sale or, you know?
Yeah, I think I hate objects sometimes, but they're so much better at revealing potentially controversial histories than I am. So with the video, there's kind of these moments where it'll kind of break out of the kind of narrative of the Replacements and go into this interview footage of myself, and there's often either footage of someone walking through a museum or footage of this kind of kitschy collection of items. And it really makes sense for me in the space that it's in, because it's being shown in a space that features essentially my kitschy collection of replacements memorabilia, all their kind of records, albums, CDs, tapes, because of course I have to have everything in triplicate or whatever, and then also kind of other various things that I've picked up along the way. But one of the things that really kind of interested me with approaching this exhibit and thinking about the replacements is, and this also gets back to kind of why the exhibit is titled the way it is, since I was not around when the replacements really were a band, the only way that I get to experience them is through prior recordings and other kind of memorabilia and objects that have been left behind. But with a band like the replacements, you know, I just told the anecdote of them throwing their master tapes in the Mississippi River, where they just apparently just don't give a shit at all about their product. It seems, you know, very ironic that I would end up spending all this time trying to regain something that is not at all what they were focused on. And with the other kind of objects as well, whether it's, you know, art museums, other collections, it's interesting to me to consider kind of what the organizational principles are, or kind of how you establish a system of organization and presentation that tries to illuminate histories in a manner when they seem to be kind of inadequate descriptors of something. Particularly, if I'm using the example of art museums, when you look at a lot of performance art that now is documented primarily through film, video, photography, but is an entirely different thing if you were there at the time it was being done, much like any replacements concert.
Oh yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, because I'll see a live band or something, mm-hmm. and listen to even just maybe their recorded stuff, and it's a completely different feel. Mm-hmm. But yeah, going to watch like a live video of that same show or something, you can't replace actually being there in person and experiencing it with the band and, mm-hmm. and everybody else that's there as well.
Yeah.
So, but can I interject here real fast? I just want to say, you listen to We Jam Iconos, is Steve Sewell and Liz Patterson. We're having a conversation about art and Steve's new show, Behind the Curve, at For Culture. If you want to participate in this conversation at all, you can send an email to dj@hollowearthradio.org, or you can call us at 206-905-1250. Sorry, just wanted to get that out there. I forgot about that. And see if we get some people to ask some questions. But
so when we were talking earlier about, you know, attributing you know, meaning to art objects or just objects in general, and I'm just curious, you know, because you bought most of this mm-hmm. off of, on eBay, or how did you acquire most of the collection, and do you have any stories about, you know, who you bought from, and also you know, was it interesting to see like what value people put on these objects, like what they were willing to, you know, receive mm-hmm. in exchange for that, you know, feeling of attachment to their object?
So some of this stuff I already owned. A lot of it though was purchased through eBay, and I can actually, so one thing I did forget to mention, so in addition to kind of this larger display of replacements memorabilia that I have, and then the two video works, there's also kind of features prominently when you walk into the gallery, a ticket stub from a show in Minneapolis in 1987, and then two snapshots of Tommy Stinson and Paul Westerberg, members of the replacements, that were taken at a show in 1987, though I have no idea which show it may have been. And then also kind of scattered throughout the gallery, if you're kind of looking for them, there are actually several other replacements tickets as well that I ended up buying as I was going through this process.
Yeah, really scattered throughout the gallery. It's almost hard to find them. Like above the door, by the bathrooms, like really scattered around.
Yeah, and the tickets are actually, they're really interesting to me, because typically, you know, having ownership of a ticket stub is kind of a very obvious indicator that you were at a certain place at a certain time and saw something. However, in my case, and actually what's really interesting is in the gallery they have the press release that they wrote up, and then there's some other information, and there's also my CV, and a quick glance at the CV would kind of show you that I finished undergrad in kind of like the 2009 is when I graduated undergrad, I think.
What's a CV?
Resume.
Oh, okay.
And that would make it just like really obvious there that I couldn't have possibly attended all these concerts. But getting to back to the kind of collecting thing, I think I directly contributed to the increased sale of replacements tickets on eBay.
You had quite a few.
Value by the minute.
And it's definitely like I ended up having to pay more than when I started for some of them.
It
was really funny when I realized that I was probably one of two people that was buying these damn things. But it was pretty easy to get a lot of stuff, but there were some other kind of interesting things that happen kind of along the way that are also kind of tied back into the replacements, particularly their second release through Twin Tone, which was an EP titled Stink, which is actually what the song Fuck School is from. That is actually a hard record to get a hold of. Actually, a lot of the records from Twin Tone are hard to get a hold of because they haven't been reissued on vinyl. And Stink, the kind of story of Stink being made gets mentioned in the longer video, but essentially they had released an album, they were kind of seeing a lot of interest and success locally and wanted to get a second record out as quickly as possible, but Twin Tone didn't have enough funding to kind of pay for a full release. So the only way that they were able to do it is Peter Jesperson, their manager, convinced them to pay for them to go to a studio and record, and agreed that basically the way that they would cut cost was by hand stamping the jacket sleeves for all the albums. So what they ended up doing is just getting, they did, I guess, potato stamps where you like carve into a potato.
Oh, yeah.
I used to do that in elementary school or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so did that
effective
like,
and cheap.
Yeah, did that in like a friend's kitchen, and it was like the band Peter Jesperson and friends, and just sat there and stamped all these album sleeves, and that was the cover that they all went out on, and they ended up making three different editions.
So it's like instant collector's items,
right?
Kind of.
Right. So that was like the ironic thing was like this decision that was purely like a pragmatic: we need to save money, but we want to get this out. Has made those like, actually now collector's items. And I actually don't have one of those. I have.
Did you find any on eBay when you were looking?
I found some on eBay, and they were selling, I think one that I was looking at ended up selling for like a couple $100.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And I ended up getting the fourth printing, which was just like a pre-printed jacket.
Yeah, yeah. I had a question for you. The other night we kind of were chatting, and first let me say this. Like, how did the opening go? How do you feel everything went that evening and,
yep.
and the show in general?
Just. Yeah, the opening was fun. A bunch of people showed up, which was really great to see, especially on a really cold January.
It was freezing.
Not too long after New Year's. So that was, that was really great. And I was actually really kind of happy to see that people seem to be engaging with the work. One kind of obvious downside is since the longer video is playing with kind of audio that just plays in the space, once
right.
enough people show up, you just can't hear it at all. So the real proof is, I suppose, in like how many people come back to see it.
Which will you ever know? Is there any record of people coming in? Or
there's a guest book that people could sign.
Okay.
But
so if you go, please sign the guest book. And did you get any interesting comments about the work, about the presentation?
Yeah. Probably the most interesting comment I got was, so there's the shorter video, which we haven't really talked about too much yet, and that's the video that seems, on some level, very out of place, but also becomes very pivotal in kind of understanding and changing the perspective on a lot of the other work in the show. So it's about a 1 minute long video, and it depicts myself waking up quite early in the morning and going and grabbing a glass of juice and just drinking it at my kitchen table. And there's a voiceover that tells this little anecdote about the glass that I'm using. And essentially, it kind of describes a situation where my girlfriend moved in with me and kind of brought a lot of stuff with her and also brought these glasses, and it's just a set of four glasses. They're all a different color. They make nice little juice glasses.
Yeah.
I was using them pretty often. I was eating yogurt out of them if I wanted to.
It's a glass.
Yeah, it's a glass. And then she ended up telling me, maybe only a few months ago, that they were actually a gift from her ex-husband, and that he had purchased them for her at the Museum of Modern Art Design store. They were made by this really famous Finnish designer. I think his name is Kaye Frank. And because of the fact that, you know, they were really expensive, they were this gift, they were this really nicely designed object, she never used them.
Yeah, right.
Wouldn't touch them. But still liked them enough and appreciated them enough as this kind of visually appealing and like kind of historically interesting object to move them all these different places that she lived. And didn't actually start using them until she noticed how casually I was handling them, which of course was because I just thought they were some cute little glasses that she got from Goodwill or something.
Right, yeah.
And so the video kind of ends with me just kind of remarking that, you know, I still use the glasses, but I feel different now when I'm going to kind of rinse one out in the sink, when I'm grabbing one from the cupboard, because there's this alteration that kind of occurred. And for me, that's kind of also what is kind of at play with my exhibit, is there's kind of this initial kind of spread of information that is kind of visually appealing and interesting to dissect and look at, but it really starts to make a lot more sense once you kind of are watching this longer video that kind of fills in some of the gaps and starts to complicate it a little further. So the short video is really, for me, just kind of a demonstration about how you know, objects have this potential to hold kind of controversial history that can really change how it's viewed and how it functions.
Yeah, I think that definitely at first, that was, I think, my first comment to you after the show. It's like, what was that video about and how did it relate? And it wasn't until later when we were talking about, you know, your walk through the art gallery and sort of that, you know, barely a link to, you know, how we feel about objects and the history that we create with them and that you were maybe playing off of that. And it was sort of like the aha moment as you work your way through the gallery. It's sort of the last piece that you see. And so you sort of, I don't know, have that self-reflexive moment or something. Is that, and that I know, at least I assume, is something that you kind of strive for in your work. And I don't know, can you tell more about that a little bit? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely agree with that. Like, there is a kind of level of self-awareness in making it, and even something that I try to kind of make come through in the longer video when you kind of see these shots of it starts with kind of a close-up shot of me, but then it goes to these wide shots where you can tell that I'm sitting in my apartment in front of my bed, and you can see kind of like the light stands to the side. And the video actually, I think, and the last shot, you see me just kind of stand up and turn the lights off and hit the stop record button, and that kind of dispels any assumption that maybe I was being interviewed by someone. And at that point, it becomes pretty aware that, no, I've just been sitting in my apartment alone talking to the camera, making up stories about the replacements because I feel like I could talk about them in very convincing in manners, which...
Yes, let me say, you can. you definitely know your stuff.
That's true.
Which for me is like kind of like the performative aspect of the work. But, yeah, so kind of generating that self-awareness and kind of using that even as a way to essentially start to pull the exhibit apart from within. And that's kind of how the ticket stubs that are kind of scattered everywhere kind of work for me as well, is to kind of start to cast some doubt on how these things work and how kind of these relationships are kind of very tenuously being created, but are still grounded in very real histories and very personal histories, but just at different times and different places. One thing I just remembered, though, getting back to your question of what kind of feedback I got. The reason I was talking about the short video is someone came up to me and was complimenting me on that piece, and they said, they were saying, like, the voiceover was really nice, like, the pacing was good, and they're like, it's really nice that you're able to kind of affect kind of an effeminate tone to your voice, and all I could think was, that's just how I talk.
Yeah, right. Not exactly what I was going for, but thank you. Yeah, I'm sure it's got to be interesting to be standing in this room that's full of, you know, your work, and all these people are sitting there judging you or it, and I don't know. I mean, can you talk about how that felt at all? Is that I mean, you've had that experience before, I guess, but
yeah. Well, openings are really soft events, I guess would be a good way to put it. I usually tell the story about, like, whenever I would go to friends' openings and they would ask me, you know, what do you think?
Right.
I'd always just kind of immediately respond, I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah.
Like, it's your opening. Like, I'm here to support you. Like,
right.
You know, say
yep.
Congratulations. Throw you a softball. Like, and that's really a kind of how I think most openings function. Usually the people that come up to talk to you aren't going to be like, this doesn't make any sense, and
well,
I hate this.
I mean, maybe not so much the comments, but, like, do you feel like an awkward tension between you and these people who, I don't know, I mean, they're there to judge you, kind of,
yeah.
In a way, right? I mean, that's kind of, they're also, I mean, there's a lot of things that's going on. They're there to appreciate it and support you and everything, but I don't know. I mean, to me, I think I would be, like, really nervous and a bundle of anxiety or something.
Well, I mean, after 6 years of academic art study, you get used to people talking
sure.
about your work, so it isn't so bad. But yeah, you're right. There is definitely that kind of level of, you know, people are formulating opinions. They're trying to make connections, trying to kind of relate their own experiences to what they're seeing. And a lot of it is largely unspoken unless they make a point to contact you later or come up to you that evening to tell you about it. So it's definitely great when people actually do that and do kind of either ask questions or, you know, make comments or even, you know, challenge you on some level to kind of, you know, explain things or
yeah, kind of definitely
change things. And but a lot of it, you're right, is largely kind of this under the surface thing that's going on, whereas above that is the kind of congratulations,
yeah.
The work looks great. Like, yeah.
Well, on the whole, you look like you're having a lot of fun.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think every single piece that I've seen you work on, you always laugh about it. You always just look like you're enjoying the process of it. And it's fun as a viewer because I think, you know, I was at that talk over a year ago, and it was about halfway through the talk, you know, Steve's supposed to be describing his work and, you know, where he's come from and what he's going to be, you know, what he's done in the past year and a half, what he'll be coming up with in his final show. And, you know, and the entire way through, you straight-faced just gave this talk about a band the entire way through. And it was really about halfway when I realized you had no intention whatsoever to switch over to talk about your own work. And really, it was such a great reflection of who you are and what you do. And so it was really fun. This show was such a great, great experience. And
nice.
And I'm just curious, so I know you're heading off to L.A., next, so do you want to talk at all about that, or it's pretty exciting what's coming up for you now? And
maybe before that, kind of branching on the talk I gave with the kind of refusal to talk about my own work in that instance, that's definitely something that has also kind of interested me very much about the replacements, and kind of the reason I was using them is this, is you could call it almost like a politics of resistance, where, you know, the replacements, you know, we were talking about this earlier too, the replacements were not a political band, especially in an era in like the 80s where all you had to do to be a political band was play three chords really fast and just yell fuck Ronald Reagan over and over again. But the replacements really didn't do any of that, but then they did these things that seemed very self-subversive or that they just weren't going to follow tradition. You know, classic examples being, you know, their live performances that could be either, like, really great or just really, really shitty. And just by the nature of their actions, they essentially became a political band. And it's very interesting to me where kind of the personal can become political just by very kind of passive modes of resistance that the replacements used and that I've kind of used and kind of continue to explore in my own work and thinking about kind of power relations and how that works. And so, yeah, that's essentially where it was coming from, all that for me. But you're right. In late February, I'll be going to Los Angeles in order to attend the Mountain School of Arts, which is a program that's been going on for several years now, run by a group of artists there. And essentially, it's a free program that happens every winter. It lasts about 3 months. And you attend classes that are led by a lot of local artists, curators, and people of such repute in LA. So I beyond that, I really don't know what the program will be like in terms of its structure and curriculum, but it'd be a really great opportunity to kind of be in a different environment, meet people, and kind of explore another place.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it's going to be a great time of just, you know, pushing your boundaries and your ideas and bouncing ideas off of other people as well. So
yeah.
I'm excited to see what comes out of it.
Me too.
Yeah, for sure. Will we get a chance to see?
Oh, I'm sure at some point.
Yeah, Chad, did you have a question? Yeah, Chad joined us here. He's got a question for Steve.
One of the things that struck me when I first walked in, like, I saw a set list and, you know, the song names, and they were just, like, so absurd. It seemed like a made-up band, like a satire on, like, a band. Did that ever, like, strike you? Like, these guys are, like, so ridiculous, they are just a complete satire of a band? That's the self-subversive thing?
Right, right. It's funny you mention that because that actually was a comment that I heard from a few people at the opening, which didn't surprise me entirely because the Replacements aren't exactly like the most popular band ever. They're a very popular band in certain kind of groups where they're, you know, very well known. But outside of that, in the mainstream, they really haven't enjoyed a lot of success. So there were actually several people who came from and were like, did you fabricate a band?
So absurd.
It's one of those things that, like, I don't think ever had occurred to me that someone would approach it that way, but then when it did happen, it wasn't that surprising, but it was something that I hadn't even thought of, really. But that is kind of an interesting point to make, because they essentially were doing, at times, their best imitation of what a band was supposed to do, and then other times that were probably more true to the Replacements, just like things that no band should do, like like getting banned off of Saturday Night Live.
What happened with that?
Oh, yeah. So they had, that was kind of when they made the transition to Sire Records, which was also kind of a weird move for them, because they had kind of built up a reputation of being this band that just kind of was not going to play along with the games, was going to be very kind of antagonistic towards any kind of level of success, and seemed like they just really were not looking for that. And then they left their kind of hometown label and moved to this larger, you know, subsidiary of Warner Brothers. And of course, what comes along with that is promotion. You can almost like refer to that as the Replacements' image phase, where like they started promoting the music, but also started promoting the band. And so they worked out a way for them to appear on Saturday Night Live. And they showed up, and before they could even play, because of their reputation for just kind of drunken disorderly, they had to sign an agreement that basically said they wouldn't swear during their performances. And so they played their first song, and about halfway through, Paul Westerberg stepped back from the microphone and just mouthed, "Fuck," at the crowd. And so that kind of avoided that agreement. And then and they were also all just like really drunk. They showed up at the next song and all of them had switched clothing.
That's awesome.
And like, instead of singing Kiss Me on the Bus, Paul Westerberg was singing Kiss Me on the Butt. And then they trashed their dressing room and just were after that, they were just kicked off the show and were banned from ever appearing on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, has that, have they wiped all existence of that? Because I don't see it on YouTube anywhere. But
you, if you dig far enough, you can actually
you can find
the performances. And you can see, like, Paul Westerberg step back and yell, fuck, and, like,
that's
everything
awesome.
Else. Yeah.
Sweet. You have something else, Jabby?
What happened to these guys? Like, you know, they seem like they, like, would die in horrific accidents.
And actually, well, no, that's, so that's
drug
probably
overdose.
A great point to,
I know there's that letter, I think it was from the manager, I don't know if it was to a label about how one of the members had fallen off, out of a tree in his 20s
right, yeah.
and broken his leg.
Nice.
The hijinks.
Nice. Actually, it's, okay, so it's kind of funny, and probably like a perfect segue,
yeah.
too, so... The band broke up in 1991, actually at a concert at Grant Park in Chicago, which is, if anyone tuned in right at 9:30, they would have heard the radio intro to that concert. And essentially what ended up happening at that show is they were out on tour supporting the album All Shook Down, which was actually a Paul Westerberg solo album, but they released it under replacement's names. So the band was playing these songs, a lot of their kind of tension, it was a lot of tension, they were strained relationships at that point in terms of creative direction and control. And so they got to their last song and they did the song Hootenanny, and one by one, they just wouldn't, like, I think it was maybe Slim Dunlap, the guitarist or whatever, who had replaced Bob Stinson, just like put his guitar down and walked off stage. And a roadie
That's
came
awesome.
On and picked up the instrument and kept playing, and the band just started walking off the stage until essentially all that was left, the replacements were essentially replaced by their roadies who finished this song, and that was their last show. And it just ended at that point when the roadies kind of realized that the replacements weren't even there anymore. It was just,
pretty perfect.
It was just
yeah.
like a group of them. Which I think we could actually...
That's not the CBGB one, is it?
No.
No.
Playing some stuff from the CBGB would be good, too. So that was a live show in 1984 in New York. Of course, CBGB. But they had found out that a bunch of label executives were going to be at this show, and they got really drunk and played this incredibly long show. I think when I burned it to disc, it ended up filling two discs with music. But it's
the
pretty
songs
much
are like
all
2 minutes
covers. And like even when they played their own songs, they played it to the tune of other ones. Like, yeah. What is one of them?
September
like,
Girls by Customer, I think. Is that
yeah,
what
yeah.
is?
So
and then,
the Customer is their song, but they're playing it to the tune of September Girls.
Okay. Yeah, and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Yeah.
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 So, you want to play some of that stuff?
Yeah,
and
go
then,
for it.
And then you can get set up on the accordion. And
yeah, sounds great. We'll play some of those songs, and then we'll play the.
And
we'll play the replacements last song ever, and
yeah.
then
awesome.
do some accordion.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Steve.
That's great. Yeah.
And thanks
Steve.
Liz, for coming in. This was a lot of fun. I hope you had a good time. And,
yeah. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're not done yet, but the interview portion is complete. All right. We're gonna go play some the replacements from the CBGB live in New York, December 9th, 1984. Thanks for listening to We Jam McConnell on Hollow Earth Radio. If you wanna call and talk to us, feel free. It's 206-905-1250 or shoot us an email at dj@hollowearthradio.org.